Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and we're going to have a very good time tonight. I am with three really bright guys who are, and we're going to do theology tonight, and we're going to do science, and especially we're going to do technology. One of the things that I really like, and you can probably tell from those who've listened to enough of the podcast, I'm like one of these guys that thinks Mormon theology has a lot of robust ideas, lots of interesting angles on the world's problems and questions, and it kind of solves certain dilemmas, or at least it shows a direction that typical philosophy and theology doesn't always go. And with us tonight are two guys, especially, who take Mormon theology as seriously as I do, and probably even more so. And they're doing it within the context of a larger discussion that is addressing the transformation that we are going through in our society with technology advancing at the rate that we have it advancing. And so there's this discussion out there called transhumanism, and it's got all sorts of different kinds of angles on it, and these guys are engaging Mormon ideas on that. And with us is Tyson Jacobson, who many of you will remember from a Mormon Stories podcast. Tyson is also a big part of the online communities that surround Mormon Stories. And so Tyson is a real science and religion guy and leans more towards secular sort of solutions than religious solutions. So we're excited to have the mix of these guys on the podcast. And Tyson, I'm just going to start and let you introduce yourself, if you would, better than what I just did. But if you can give us 30 seconds or a minute on your background and stuff, we'd love to have you say hello to our listeners.
Okay, well, on the leaning side, I think I've leaned as far as you can from Dawkins' scale of 1 to 7. I'm a 6.9, and I like to quote Neil deGrasse Tyson when he says that I remain unconvinced that anything other than rapid decomposition is the fate of my mind and body after death. I've accomplished enough in life so that I do not fear death. In fact, I've left instructions for my epitaph. Horace Mann, a quote from Horace Mann, "Be ashamed to die until you have scored some victory for humanity." That's the creed I live by and will die by. I really like the reality of approaching life, making the purpose that you have and your purpose in life, and so that's for the last 3 or 4 years, it's been a journey for me discovering that out of Mormonism and into secular humanism, and a lot of what these conversations that we'll have going forward is right along the lines of or paralleling the secular or the humanist approach to life.
Cool. And yeah, what we have here, and all three of you are guys that have taken science very, very seriously, embraced the vision that it's putting forth in many, many ways, and we will have that divergence a little bit where Lincoln and Chris, who we'll just introduce here in a second, take a little bit more robustly that mythology and religion has an important role to kind of imbue the ethics going forward into this new future. So anyway, we're excited to have Lincoln Cannon with us. Lincoln, would you introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dan. As Dan mentioned, my name's Lincoln, last name's Cannon. I'm the president of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. We'll probably be talking a lot more about that this evening. But basically, from a worldview perspective, I'm a lifelong Mormon, although I identify quite strongly with more naturalistic interpretations of Mormonism, more humanistic, specifically transhumanistic interpretations of Mormonism. I'm in love with pragmatism. When I read William James years ago, I enjoyed it so much that I named my middle son after William James. My middle son's middle name is William James, quite literally.
Awesome.
I love the writings of Joseph Smith, love the much of the writings of Brigham Young, read the Journal of Discourses regularly as a teenager. So, you know, I really enjoy Mormonism. I enjoyed philosophy. And then professionally, I'm a programmer by trade. I spend a lot of time managing other programmers, and currently I'm employed by a medical device manufacturer, and I run sales and marketing technology for them, creating custom web and mobile applications and integrating with their information systems and such. So professionally, I'm on the technical side. My love is on the more philosophical side. I studied philosophy at BYU, ended up getting an MBA from BYU because I didn't think anybody would pay me to be a philosopher.
I can testify that they don't.
Yeah, it's difficult.
I've been to your house. Difficult. It was a good move.
No, but there's a balance here. I mean, I really enjoy both sides of it, and I think my education and my profession and my hobbies reflect that interest in the balance between the practical and the theoretical.
Yeah, and knowing you for the last 6 or 7 years like I have, I can attest that what you just said really does capture a lot of you. So thank you so much for coming on. We're excited to hear you reflect on all these things. Christopher Bradford, love having you on. Thanks for coming on. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm happy to be on. So like Lincoln, I also work in the software field. I've worked in the software field for a long time. I'm currently working at Ancestry.com, and I manage mobile and social application development there. And I really love the technology. But like Lincoln, also my degree is in the humanities. I got a linguistics degree from BYU. And I've found that, an understanding of language comes in handy in a lot of different ways. And I think ties in nicely with philosophy, religion, story, and as you mentioned early on, sort of the power of myth. Some of the most memorable things that I studied at BYU were about the power of mythology. I am the father of 8 children and gave a presentation at Sunstone a while back about the case for having large families. it's a big challenge, but I learn a lot from it, and it can be a lot of fun too. I am the vice president and a co-founder of the Mormon Transhumanist Association, and I'm happy to be on the show.
It was great to have you guys, and we were all together last night for 3 or 4 hours and had fun, and we're going to try to take the most fun things there, and also hopefully the most approachable things. I'm a little bit worried about our audience today, and so those of you who are tuning in are used to sometimes or really kind of like those shows. It's more Mormonism in the pews. We're not going to get that, but yet we will too. We're gonna keep you in mind, so we hopefully won't lose you in any of this discussion of stuff. But again, as I sort of led in with, this is robust Mormonism. These are specific, interesting ideas of Joseph Smith that he put forth that these guys especially think have relevance for the future that we're entering into. So if you don't mind, Chris, I'm going to go to you. You kind of gave me a nice, if you were introducing Mormon transhumanism to somebody for the first time, you kind of had a nice little spiel there that kind of framed it. And I think we can use that as a good little jumping off point so our audience can kind of catch on too.
Yeah, when I introduce Mormon transhumanism to people, of course, usually the first question is, what is transhumanism? And then more specifically, Mormon transhumanism. And transhumanism is really a largely secular and strongly atheist movement that focuses on the effects of rapidly advancing technology on society, on humanity, on the world, and how we can harness that in a responsible way, and really focusing on the benefits that we can gain from this. And a group of us, 5 or 6 years ago, I guess, became aware of these transhumanist concepts, and they really resonated with us, not just from a scientific or technological perspective, but really because we saw a lot of parallels between transhumanist views of how the future might go and the kinds of changes that we will see as technology advances, and religious thought, in particular Mormon thought, about the possibilities for the future and that application to us as humanity. And we also thought that there was a need to inject some religious thought and moral considerations into this largely secular and atheist movement. Conversely, we also see that there has been developing in recent years a real anti-science bent in religious thought, much religious thought. And so we really wanted to form an organization that could help to bridge that gap, to introduce the value of religious thought on the scientific transhumanist side, but also to help people in the religious community be aware and maybe not feel so threatened by science, and see, you know, how we can reconcile it and really see the parallels that we really admire and love to point out and to investigate further.
Cool. Thank you. That's very, very good. Lincoln, can I ask you to do something? And then I've got a question for you, Tyson, about morals and whatnot, as he was talking about, inject some. I think you probably could come at it from an interesting angle, saying that they're there, but just from a different source. But Lincoln, can you just enhance what Chris said by naming some of these imminent, or at least these changes, this rapidly? I'd love to some more of a flavor of what is changing. What are the emerging technologies? How is the world, going faster? Tell us about Moore's Law and all those different kinds of things, just to sort of paint the picture.
Yeah, the you named the most obvious one for most of us, right? And that's the changes we're seeing in information technology over just the last 15 years or so. We've seen information technology completely change the world, predominantly because of the internet. Underneath the covers, as you mentioned, there's something known as Moore's Law. Really, it's more of an observation than a law.
Right, right.
Gordon Moore, who was, I think he was the founder of Intel, but an executive at Intel in the 1960s. He observed that the ratio of processing power to price was doubling at the time, I think, every 2 years for computing components. And that trend that he observed many decades ago has continued up to this day, and we've seen billionfold increases in our computing capacity. And they're really, some people have been proclaiming the end of Moore's Law, and others have been pointing out that there are ways that Moore's Law can continue. There's some controversy there, but by and large, we're seeing that our computing capacity is continuing to increase at an exponential rate, and in some ways at a meta-exponential rate. And it's doing that in more ways than even just processing power. We're seeing the same things happening in computer storage, and we're seeing the same things happen in the amount of data that's transmitted wirelessly. There's a whole bunch of facts and figures we could get into, and anybody could find them by Googling, exponential change in computing technology. You'd find 1,000 trends there. Other interesting things that are happening is, we're seeing 3D printing coming, where people can use a printer to print 3D objects. Historically, we've pretty much just printed flat things, ink on paper, right? Well, now we can print 3D objects. It's kind of expensive right now, but the prices are coming down quickly. One of the interesting things that I've seen printed, I've held in my hands, are some human blood vessels. Those we can now print tissue, or organic tissue, right out of a 3D printer. And other interesting things that we're seeing coming include, all of the things that we've seen consequent to the mapping of the human genome. So probably personalized medicine. How quickly will be getting that? When will it be practical? I don't know, but it's close. The cost of sequencing a person's genome is decreasing at an exponential rate. Chances are that we'll be able to have, an individual's personal genome sequenced for, $100 within this decade. And other interesting trends, you know, we have the decentralization of energy production through solar collection. Right now, if you look at the trends in solar energy production, you'll find exponential trends there too. And basically, the amount of energy, the efficiency of solar collection is improving at an exponential rate, and the cost is decreasing at an exponential rate.
Woohoo!
Yeah, some amazing things are happening, and these are just, you know, some examples that come to mind.
Right, but then we got to go nanotechnology, robotics, and just, you know, it's the world is changing, and I guess where I'm at is just like I am really glad that there's this discussion where people are really getting into the implications of this, rather than just have everybody driven by profit motive and gee, I can dream it, I'm going to make it, and you know, consequences be damned, you know, that kind of thing. I'm glad to have so many good minds working on this.
Yeah,
and, Dan, do you mind if I add one other observation? I think there's something else that's really interesting, and in part the technologies that Lincoln mentioned are enabling this, but we're also seeing exponential advances in our understanding of things. So we're seeing, for example, our ability to look at the human body, or to look at how the brains of animals work, or to look at how ecology works and how the biological world around us works. That kind of knowledge is also increasing at an exponential rate. Our ability to understand these things and our tools for investigating these things, that's another, I think, really important piece of the advances that we're seeing in science.
Awesome. Great. Okay, so the world is going to change, and we'll a little bit later in the podcast we'll introduce some of the terminology and whatnot that a lot of transhumanists point towards a singularity and various things like that. But Tyson, I want to bring you in right here. Well, here's what I want to do here in a minute. I want a bit more about the Mormon Transhumanist Association. I want to kind of know, you know, autobiographies of Lincoln and Chris, at least to the idea, and as well as what they can generalize about the Mormons who tend, or the people who tend to join the Mormon Transhumanist Association. I want to get a better feel for that, because I have a feeling that those autobiographies and those sensibilities are going to connect with lots of our listeners. So I want to do that, but I didn't want to let us go too far, Tyson, from the idea of, you know, here's Lincoln and Chris and others who are saying this is going forth, and it's largely a secular, largely a humanist, largely an atheistic kind of group that is pushing, you know, imagining this in the future, and they're saying we need to make sure the ethics and morals and mythology kind of plays, and you probably might disagree with them there, or where would you see that ethics and morals actually are in that discussion, even without explicit religion?
So I guess the question really would be, from my perspective, why would you need to bring in a myth or any type of religious dogma into a scientific approach to either ethics, metaethics, or morality, and completely reverse the conversation as to why would we want to consider starting out at the point from a biblical perspective or a Book of Mormon perspective, and bringing in those ideas of morality instead of starting from a scientific perspective. So I think there's been a lot of debate most recently. Well, I mean, you can go way back in philosophy, but from the atheist's perspective, I guess, the crowd, there's been some debate that we couldn't necessarily discuss morality, or that morality was in the realm of religion and philosophy. And I think that's been challenged successfully. A.C. Grayling has several books. He's very prolific on the subject. Sam Harris has been very prolific on the subject. So I would try and reframe the question completely different as to why we would need to incorporate these myths. And I think that helps bring the conversation back to Lincoln and Chris, as to when they say, well, two questions I would have for them is, the first, why do we need to bring it in? But why would you be concerned about the secular approach to ethics and morality? For an example, hammer blows of modernity have been the primary reasons for rejection of slavery. That's, if not necessarily endorsed, but certainly acquiesced to in these old scriptures. So we can see that incorporating some of these modern approaches to ethics has been a positive influence on morality. So what are some of the objections of that continuing to occur? So those would be the two questions that I'd want to put back to you guys to help, because I can go off and espouse my own morality and ethics, but I think it's more interesting to hear from the Mormon transhumanist perspective.
Well, can I respond to that, Dan? Do you mind?
Yeah. No, take it away.
I think that's a great question, and I want to dispel one thing really quickly, and that is I don't think that a person has to have faith in God to be a moral person. You know, that's something that we often hear religious people say, and I just think it's clearly not true. So, you know, the question then arises, well, if we don't need religion to be moral, to treat each other well, and et cetera, why would we need religion? Or maybe even backing up one step further, let me add one more thing before I talk about religion, and that is, can science help us with morality? It's been a year or two, it seems like. Sam Harris, who's a really well-known atheist, has been advocating an argument for using science to help us inform our morality. And by and large, I think Sam Harris's efforts are quite right. Science can help us get an objective sense of what is good for humanity. You know, to use kind of maybe a silly example, we could scan a billion person's brains, figure out what makes them happy, abstract it across it all, and make some fairly objective statements about, you know, if everybody loves each other, I'm using a silly example, if everybody loves each other, everybody will be happier, so we should love each other, right? Based on the results of a person feeling loved when they're wearing one of these scanners. And you can actually make better examples than that, but just to use a simple one, there you go. So I think science is an important informer of our morality. So where does religion come in? If we don't need religion to behave morally, and if science can help improve our understanding of morality, what's the point of religion? To answer that question, first of all, I'd say that you have to understand religion in a particular way. If you're going to talk about religion as, say, just religious fundamentalism, well, then I don't think religion has anything at all really to do with morality. It has a lot to do with immorality, in my opinion. I'm not a fan of religious fundamentalism, as you can tell. But if you define religion in terms of maybe a kind of a sociological perspective, and I'll throw out there the way I like to define religion, and that is that religion is any ideology that provokes the strenuous mood, particularly any ideology that provokes the strenuous mood for a community or a group of people.
So, and for the layperson, what is the strenuous mood?
Yeah.
So, that, William James.
That's stolen straight out of pragmatism. You're right, Dan. And the idea of the strenuous mood is, you know, passion, passion to act, passion, you know, not just kind of. Neither an apathy nor just a, yeah, I agree with that, but something that provokes the desire to behave differently than you would otherwise. So religion then is this thing that when you encounter it, it provokes something in you. And, you know, this is maybe a little bit of an unusual definition of religion, because, for example, Apple products provoke the strenuous mood in some people. And I'm not saying this lightly. There's actually studies that have been done where people, Apple fans, and I'm talking about Apple, the computer manufacturer here, Apple fans have been put into brain scanners, and they've been shown the symbols of Apple products, and people, like, say, Christians, have been strapped into those same brain scanners and seen symbols of crucifixes or whatever, and the same parts of their brains are activated. These people have religious type responses to what many people consider secular symbols. But there's more than that going on. It's not just a secular symbol. This is something that is provoking deeper emotions, maybe what I would call a sublime aesthetic in them. And so it moves people in a different way. And that right there is what I'll say that we need religion for. Now, some people will say, well, science can provoke the strenuous mood too. And I'll argue that it's not the science that's provoking it. It's the religion. It's a layer of aesthetic that we're putting on top of the science, if indeed science is provoking the strenuous mood. So what we need is we need religion broadly defined, as I've just defined it. We need something that can move people to pursue hopefully good ends. Now, there are some bad religions too. Not all religion provokes the strenuous mood for good things. For example, some religions provoke the strenuous mood for killing other people. What we need is a religion that provokes a strenuous mood for compassion and for creativity. And the reason we need this from a practical perspective is that humanity faces very serious risks. You know, there's very serious suffering in the world. There are natural risks that we face. There are incredible technological risks that we face. You know, everybody knows the risks from nuclear weapons, but there are bigger risks than that coming our way. So we need the strenuous mood for practical reasons to face the risks that are hurtling towards us. And then not just the risks, but also to pursue the opportunities that we have before us. Because maybe if we don't pursue these opportunities with every bit of energy that we're capable of, then we won't achieve those possibilities. Maybe we won't achieve those heights of sublime creativity and compassion because we just weren't motivated enough. And so that is what I would argue is the contribution of religion, is that it is a spiritual mover. It's an aesthetic. It's something that makes us, that works on our desires, pulls us together as a community, and makes things happen. That's the value proposition of religion, in my opinion.
And you don't think transhumanism has that currently?
Well, it does to an extent. I have several friends who are religious transhumanists who are not Mormon or not any other, you know, mainstream religion. And what they will argue back and forth with other transhumanists is that transhumanism itself is an emerging modern religion. And I think that there's indeed a lot of accuracy to that criticism of transhumanism, even though there are many transhumanists that will vehemently disagree with that framing of transhumanism. When I look at transhumanism, it's only a few decades old explicitly, right? The word transhumanism, people identifying as transhumanists, this movement is only a few decades old. What I see happening is people engaging in theological explorations implicitly rather than explicitly and at a faster rate than we have historically in, you know, traditional theology, but they're doing the same things and they don't even know it, that they're dealing with the same kinds of problems that theologians have been dealing with for thousands of years. So yes, I do think transhumanism does it. Now, why is that not enough for me? Why am I not just a religious transhumanist? Well, there's kind of two answers to that. Number one is that I think Mormonism is a transhumanism. Authentic Mormonism is a transhumanism. So before I even knew the word transhumanism or transhumanist, I was a transhumanist. That's what I've come to realize, in the last 6 to 8 years. As I've encountered transhumanists and I've bumped into their ideas and I've understood their worldviews, I've come to realize, you know what? These guys see the world very much the same way that I do. And, you know, they've come at it from different angles. But I was raised, without calling it this, a transhumanist by my Mormon parents. And that's part of it. Part of the answer is Mormonism is a transhumanism for me. And then the other part of it is I think that the Mormon aesthetic, the Mormon myth, the Mormon story, the Mormon cosmos is bigger, more beautiful, better developed, more inspiring, particularly for me and the people that are closest to me, than kind of this more youthful fledgling movement that we call transhumanism. So transhumanism alone is not enough for me. It's not enough. It doesn't inspire me that the spirit isn't in there as strongly for me without keeping my Mormonism in it. So I'm very definitely a Mormon transhumanist, not just a transhumanist.
What would be the contrary position from an Orthodox LDS member? What would their argument be against that, that Mormonism is not transhumanist?
You know, we talked about transhumanism movement to deal with these technologies. Work on the term for a second there, Lincoln, because I'm not sure when you say Mormonism is a transhumanism, to give the spirit of that term, transhuman, move us into post-human, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Let's look at the word itself from a couple of perspectives. Transhumanism, look at the word in two ways. Number one, think of it as trans-humanism. So transhumanism is an evolution of humanism as a philosophy. So already right there, you've got to realize that transhumanism is about more than technology, right? It's about values and human flourishing and all of the things that have come to be associated with humanism. And it's important that we point out that humanism is not necessarily secular. In fact, the argument could be made that humanism started as a religious thing, as kind of as an offshoot of Christianity, even the argument can be made. So you've got transhumanism as this evolving humanism. Maybe that's one way of looking at the word. Another way of looking at the word is transhuman-ism. And this touches on the perspective that we are creatures in transition. We are evolving, and we are evolving towards something greater than that which we are now, hopefully. Maybe we're evolving towards something worse. That, you know, we would want to avoid that. We would want to mitigate those risks. So, and not only that, but this transhumanism touches on this idea that not only are we evolving, but we're getting to the point where we are not evolving just at the whim of perhaps what is, so far as we can tell, random mutations, but we are starting to take control of our own evolution through our technology, through our scientific understanding of the world. We are becoming empowered over the direction of our evolution. So that's the transhuman-ism.
And how is that, like, through longer life, through all the different technological enhancements? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, there? And even in very simple ways. I mean, imagine going in to get LASIK surgery, right? Or imagine going into, people have all sorts of prosthetic joints these days, or they're wearing glasses,
right.
Or even clothing is a form of prosthetic skin. We could talk about all kinds of other ways that are maybe more futuristic sounding, but transhumanism isn't so radical in its beginnings. It's just an observation that humanity is something that has been evolving. To say that humanity is something static is to not understand humanity at all. We've been in flux.
Exactly.
In fact, because of our technological progress, our pace of change is only accelerating now, right?
So now back to the Orthodox Mormon position.
Yeah.
You've now opened it up to just like, well, if you buy that Mormonism's eternal progression and the idea of, you know, what Joseph Smith says is the job of our life here is to transform ourselves into gods, you know, eventually.
You must learn to become gods yourself.
The answer, yeah.
That's exactly the answer. Deification, which is an ancient, ancient, ancient idea. This is not just Mormonism, right? There's strong evidence for it in early Christianity. There's evidence for it. You know, we can even find it in the Bible. Man was created in the image of God in Genesis, right? That idea was there thousands of years ago. And there's texts that predate the Bible that appeal to this idea of deification or theosis. As long as humanity has been capable of projecting a God out there, they've been capable of imagining themselves working towards becoming like that. And in fact, the projection itself has incented them to try to become more like that. So that's where this connects right back into Mormonism, is that Mormonism, so far as I know, is the best, strongest, contemporary articulation of this idea of humanity flourishing into godhood. And that is why I position Mormonism as a transhumanism. It is at its heart a transhumanism. And I would argue that transhumanism, not in name, but implicitly, is as old as humanity, because we find this strain of deification going back before Mormonism, back through Christianity, back into ancient times, it's been something that our religion has been pointing our minds at, you know, for as long as we've been around. And that it's been provoking in us the strenuous mood for as long as humanity has been around.
And this gets back to the observation that I wanted to make as well in response to Tyson's question about why add religion to a scientific pursuit of morals and ethics. And part of the reason is that, as Lincoln pointed out, in part, transhumanism is covering ground that's been covered many times before. But there isn't a sense of connection back to those past conversations. And religion has been pointing us in this direction for a long time. And if we are really going to be compassionate and and try to build bridges, we need to connect back to this long past, all of the positive things in the long past, and help to cast those religious ideas in a modern framework. And this is where Mormonism, I think, is also particularly valuable, is that while it does make a break with the Christianity of the past in important ways, it also maintains a very strong connection to those, all of those values and stories and scripture and so forth. And so I think it serves as a very good bridge from the ancient religions to modernism and to bridging science and religion in ways that help us recognize their compatibility rather than seeing them as in opposition to each other.
Good. Now, Tyson, when you framed the question, you said the Orthodox Mormon position. Was there something behind that that would basically say that you don't think the Orthodox Mormon position is what Lincoln and Chris have suggested, that deification, you know, we're on our way to something greater. Is that outside the Orthodox Mormon position for you, as you understand it?
I've got a couple of answers to that. One is, I think we have a bias as pattern-seeking primates to look for evidences that support our position. And I would think that, and I wanted to broach that question to try and illustrate the spectrum that exists between, which I think is a fairly enlightened approach to Mormonism versus some that are more grounded into, I would say, archaic thinking. And a couple examples come to mind. For instance,
these guys would say that too, I think.
Right. Well, I there's, we're of one mind on many things. That's very evident. So I want to try and keep the conversation in their court. And I'd want to ask, now I'd like to ask them the church's position on, the church's position on stem cell research. Last I looked, that they were not pro or con. Whereas from a humanist perspective, stem cell research is maybe a technology that was, 10 to 20 years ago was settled. So what do they think is pulling the church to a position where it's clear that at some point in time they'll adopt the ethics of stem cell research? From, this is my guess, but what's pulling them, Lincoln and Chris, what's pulling them to that position? I don't know that it's the language of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. I would think that looking back at what they said, that we are cherry picking some of the conversations that they've had, as beneficial as they are and as forward looking and thinking they are, they're also as fairly archaic thinking that exists back then. So what would be pulling the public positions of the church towards that humanism?
I think that there are a couple of things that pull the church in that direction. One is that the church, I think, positions itself very much as compatible with the discoveries of science and technology. I think it's an area in which the LDS church, relative to many other Christian denominations, is actually quite progressive. And yet, of course, there's a very strong conservative pull in the church as well. So for me, it's actually more a question of what is pulling them, you know, what is holding the church back?
It's holding
from,
them back, yeah. So what,
right,
what,
rather than what's pushing them forward, because I think that sort of the nature of the church in its evolution has been very progressive, and I think that it's only in, you know, the last half century or so that we've seen a much stronger conservatism, a much more identification with that sort of movement. And I think part of it is just inherent in large organizations to a certain extent. Some of it has to do, I think, with the makeup of the leadership of the church, the fact that seniority plays a large role in succession. And so we have a strong conservative pull there. And then the concern that the church has with, you know, how it's viewed in the Christian sphere, I think that there's some concern probably there as well about being seen as not Christian because we don't share some of the same approaches to things as other Christian denominations. I think there are a number of factors that play into some of those issues.
Okay,
but if it was our pure theology, forget it. We'd be pretty robust, right?
Well, the church is pragmatic, right?
I think the potential is there.
Think about it in terms of history. You know, I think a great example of this, you've had a podcast on this recently, the Joseph Smith perspectives. Well, you know, all the racism stuff that's come up recently, and part of that being people going back and thinking about Joseph Smith's attitudes towards slavery. And Joseph Smith, he waffled back and forth on this. Well, he appears to have waffled back and forth a bit on this slavery issue, where at one time he was considering, you know, almost an abolitionist without actually calling himself one, perhaps. And then at another time he was, you know, almost silent on it, just trying to keep people to stay out of the problem and let the slave owners be. And one of the drivers of concern in all of that is he was trying to build up his church and keep people safe and himself safe. And I think that we've seen that continue in the church for 150 years, where people, we've made changes due to the context in which we find ourselves. And sometimes, you know, those changes are things that we look back on and we're really happy about. Sometimes we're not as happy about them, but I think there's a pragmatism shining through. And for those who look at the church as an organization involved in a divine work, then they see some inspiration involved in that pragmatism.
Cool. Are you ready to move on, Tyson?
Yeah, let's do
or
it.
Or is there anything else you wanted to pick up there?
Okay. Oh, there's plenty. There's more, but I'm thinking a lot of it's going to come out as we.
And this is maybe me holding to what we had described earlier as what we were going to do. So maybe we can cut this out if it doesn't feel right to you guys right now. But before we go too far, Lincoln and Chris, you kind of shared with me last night, and I thought it was pretty interesting, sort of the typical path of a Latter-day Saint that sometimes is finding what's happening in the MTA sort of as their refuge. Do you guys mind sharing a little bit more about either the path that you guys took just very briefly or that you've seen others, and then sort of the overarching umbrella of the MTA and its diversity? Because, again, I'm trying to make sure that those who are listening to this podcast can kind of connect with you guys. You're both computer geeks, you know, and work in those industry. But I'd really love to kind of talk about, you know, that aside, you know, just general science religion stuff might be helpful. So,
yeah, let me maybe frame it in terms of some of the demographics of members of the MTA, and then talk about some specifics.
I just want to get it in here, and whether we keep it in or not, that's a side question. But yeah, go for it.
Today we have the MTA, the Mormon Transhumanist Association. We have about 150 members of the association, and the geographic spread of those members roughly mirrors that of Mormonism, right? So we have most, you know, probably 40% of our members are in Utah. And then we probably have more American members percentage-wise in the MTA than the LDS Church has in America. But anyway, we'd have a lot of international members too. We probably have, 15 to 20% of our members are international.
when it gets to their perspectives, about 77% of our members are members are also members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And also about 77% of our members, but not necessarily the same 77%, identify as theists. So by deduction, then you would say, well, what do the others identify as? Well, about 23% of the members of the MTA identify as agnostics or atheists. And then on the political side, members of the MTA tend to be more progressive politically. Over half of the members of the MTA identify as cultural progressives. But on the economic side of politics, it's very split. We have some progressives, but we have more conservatives on the economic side in the MTA. So it's a very, you know, a rather diverse group of people. The thing that is probably quite consistent among all of the members of the MTA, and I can't even think of an exception right now offhand. Maybe Chris can come up with one in a minute, but at least very generally, what brings people to the MTA is a struggle with science and religion, a struggle with philosophy and religion, a struggle with, maybe we could say, with secularism and religion. And it doesn't even have to be Mormon religion, because we have members of the MTA who are not Mormon. We have Christians, non-Mormon Christians, who are members of the MTA. We have people who aren't members of any religious organization who are members of the MTA. So, but they still are these people that they've felt strongly attached to this spiritual religious side. They've felt strongly attached to this scientific technological side, and they felt the tension between those. And the MTA has provided for many people a way of easing that tension, or even getting beyond considering it even a tension at all, but it transforms it into this mutually supportive position where science, religion, spirituality, technology, they're actually building each other up. It's not an accommodation of each other, but they're actually built for each other. That's what the MTA helps people see, and I've got tons of stories about this where the rubber meets the road, where real lives have been benefited by the MTA. So let's take it maybe from an Orthodox member of the LDS Church perspective. There are several members of the MTA that, because of the work of the MTA, have been baptized into the LDS Church. I'll kind of loosely allude to two of them without saying names or any specifics, but one was a European person who actually had never been Mormon before, ever, came into the MTA and got baptized because of the influence of the ideas in the MTA. Another was a person in the United States who had been Mormon, who had left Mormonism for, you know, philosophical, scientific reasons, and the MTA helped them reconcile those issues, and that person was baptized back into the church subsequently. So, and then there's even more stories about where people will send us emails and say, "Hey, you guys have helped me reignite my spiritual inclinations or my spiritual flame," or however they might put it. Lots of those kinds of stories. So that's what the MTA is doing. It is advocating the syncretization of science, religion, technology, spirituality, and not only is it advocating it, but it's doing that successfully. It is in the real world helping people do this and making differences in people's lives.
And I also want to suggest that there's another interesting dynamic that certainly has played out in my own story, which is that we're not simply thinking about transhumanism, but also the influence of science in our religious thinking. So I grew up in the LDS Church without ever having a sense that there was a conflict between science and religion. That wasn't an issue for me so much. But a little over a decade ago, I encountered Mormon fundamentalism that presented, you know, historical challenges to my Orthodox Mormon understanding. And I was having a really hard time reconciling what I thought I knew from my growing up years with some of the things that I was encountering from Mormon fundamentalists. So as I struggled with trying to reconcile this was about the same time that I started encountering the influence of the modern positions of science on religious thinking, and recognizing that by adopting some of the positions to help, you know, influence my religious thinking in a scientific way, that it also provided me a way to shift my understanding of my religious thinking so that I didn't have the same conflict between what I thought I had and the religious fundamentalist side that was showing me all of these historical challenges. I saw the historical challenges now in a more scientific light. And that, I think, is another great benefit, is as you start to marry these two, the scientific approach and the religious approach, that it helps to resolve a lot of problems that can arise just within religion itself when you have that sort of fundamentalist split.
Cool. Can you give like one example of how the, you know, the way you've talking about science and religion helped you handle the historical shell? Just like one example that kind of illustrates that.
Sure. So one example is the issue of Joseph Smith's multiple first vision accounts, right? And from a fundamentalist perspective, you kind of look at that and say, well, is one of them the correct, you know, way to understand that? And if so, then what does that, how does that affect our overall sort of system of thinking about Mormonism? From a scientific perspective, when you look at memory and when you look at how memory works and the fact that when we remember something, we're almost reenacting it and reliving
right,
it. And we actually have to like reconstruct the memory. It's not like some pristine thing that's sitting there to be looked at. It's something that has to be rebuilt. And so I started to see this and say, well, of course, you know, we would have multiple accounts of this, of an experience, because we all do that, right? I do it in my own life. And when I had that sort of shift and recognizing that, you know, this is a different way of thinking about spiritual experience, religious experience, prophetic experience, and so forth, that really helped me to make that reconciliation.
Cool. Very good. Thanks.
Dan, could I interject one other kind of related thing? But it's
sure.
Related in the sense of broadening the understanding of what the MTA does for people. We've talked about some of the ways that maybe the MTA has helped people from a more classical or orthodox LDS Mormon perspective. But it also helps people who aren't classical, orthodox, LDS Mormons. And I'm going to throw an example out there of a person who I know he won't mind if I mention him by name. His name's Brent Alsup. He's one of the directors on the board of directors of the MTA. And Brent identifies as a Mormon atheist. And, you know, when most people hear that, they think it's a bad joke or something. But it's not. For him, this is a very important thing. He identifies as a religious person. He does his best to participate in our culture. He's had his concerns over the years. In fact, as I understand the story, he very nearly stopped identifying as Mormon, but as he became acquainted with other people with Mormon backgrounds who were transhumanists, such as Chris and me and others that helped found the MTA, he started coming back and being interested in Mormonism again and helped us found the MTA. And the really interesting thing about Brent is that his atheism is based on this idea that God just doesn't exist yet. For him, there's nothing more important in the world than humanity engaging in eternal progression, just like we teach in Sunday school, to become like God. He just believes, his perspective, that because, you know, evidenced by, say, the problem of evil, God doesn't exist yet, because if a being that powerful existed already, then suffering would have already been abolished. So God isn't there yet. But Mormonism is true in the sense that it's pulling us to become like God, and that we are supposed to become this God. So even from these other angles, Mormon transhumanism is helping people flesh out a fulfilling and motivating and inspiring worldview it's meaningful.
Cool. Well, thanks for that. And I'm glad to get that picture from you, Chris and Lincoln, about what's going on at the story level. And again, not like this is a commercial for you guys, even though you do have a conference coming up, right?
That's right, we did.
April 6th, there's a big conference. Why don't you do that right now, and then we'll also plug it at the end as far as like the information. So what's happening on April 6th?
Yep, April 6th, we have the 2012 Conference of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. It'll be in Salt Lake City at the public library from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. There will be 25-ish members of the MTA speaking on subjects at the intersection of science, religion, technology, and spirituality. Keynote speakers will be me and Giulio Prisco, who is a former director of the European Space Agency, or director did some kind of project management stuff for the European Space Agency, and has been on the board of directors for the World Transhumanist Association, currently on the board of directors for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technology and the Italian Transhumanist Association. So a big time transhumanist in the kind of the secular bent, but he's also probably the most influential religious transhumanist in the world. So he'll be the other keynote speaker. Chris will also be speaking at the conference on a couple of really cool subjects that you can see about if you go to our website, which is transfigurism.org.
And then Michael Ferguson, who we had on the podcast just about recognizing spirit, he's on the program. I'm actually on the program too, and I'm excited about talking with the transhumanists about how some of their stuff can be brought down to earth a little bit and communicated better. So that's kind of what I'm going to try in my little 10 minutes. And these are all like really 10-minute presentations, right? It's going to be boom, boom, boom. And you're also going to live stream it.
That's right, live streamed, 10-minute presentation. The keynotes will be longer than that, but the bulk of the presentations will be more TED-style, short, to-the-point, impactful, hopefully, presentations.
Good, and the website, real fast?
Transfigurism.org. That's spelled TRANSFIGURISM, transfigurism.org.
End of commercial. Switching gears now. Conversation. Okay, we've got the general feel that transhumanism is about, you know, what's the future, and it's accelerating so fast. We need to get out in front of it. We need to think it through. We need to talk about the implications. We talked a little about morals and others and, you know, different sources for those and where you're doing it. There's a couple of key transhumanist ideas, at least, that we have not talked about. So let's at least get that introduction in. And then I want to have mostly a discussion where we kind of talk about these wonderful theological terms that in this transhumanist sort of framing really come alive, I think, in new ways. And I think our audience will really enjoy that. So who would like to lead us into, say, for instance, the concept in transhuman about the singularity? Tyson, are you prepared to at least kind of offer what you know about that? I want to make sure you have a chance to jump in here and then let these guys who are a little more active in the discussion do it. But do you have a take on that, or I'm happy just to back this out and unrecord, asking.
Definitely keep recording, because if I were to try and explain the singularity, it would definitely turn into a comedy session, I think.
Oh, all right, good. Well, okay, so you want to pass that one off to one of these guys?
Well, I don't mind. I can tell you what I know of it, and this is just through limited Googling. I like to think of my understanding of the singularity as happening as we are, as a species, continuing to become more and more intelligent, and the amount of knowledge that is out there is increasing, and it's exponentially increasing. And so the only way for us, at some point in time, the only way for us to really keep up with the information that's emerging is to incorporate that technology into our biology. And at the point where the artificial intelligence and technological intelligence blends with biological intelligence, that's the gist of my what I've heard from Ray Kurzweil's Transcendent Man and looking at his singularity conferences and also through listening to other speakers like Aubrey de Grey and Stephen Wolfram.
Okay. Great explanation.
And that's one piece of it, right? Because that's actually not the piece that I would go to first.
Yeah, I think there's another sense that is interesting. So in physics, the term singularity really implies a boundary that we can't really get through. So a black hole would be an example of a singularity. It's an event where our understanding breaks down and we can no longer apply the rules that we know to the situation at the singularity or beyond it. And sort of the idea is that with these exponentially increasing technological trends that we discussed earlier, that those are advancing so rapidly that there will come a point where the expansion of that and the progress of that will be completely unpredictable to us, because we won't, unless we, you know, figure out some way to enhance our understanding, we won't be able to predict what happens after that point in time, because the rate of change is just so fast.
Yeah, that's where I would have gone first too, yeah.
So this is kind of an extrapolation of Moore's law that we talked about earlier, right? We're seeing these trends in technology progressing at exponential rates, and people extrapolate those into the future and say, hey, if these exponential rates of progress continue into the future, at some point in time, they will be going so fast that, you know, we will not be able to predict or control them, barring the ability to improve our comprehension and our intelligence, et cetera.
But Lincoln, it's not just restricted to computing power. Right.
That's correct. Computing power is the most well-known aspect. Well, let me say yes and no. You're right that technology is progressing exponentially in many other domains. So that's the yes part. The no part is that it's particularly important in the information technology because, and this is what a type of transhumanist called a singularitarian would point out, in information technology, we are seeing the development of artificial intelligence, right? And people popularly will say, well, we don't have artificial intelligence. We've been trying to get it forever. Defined narrowly, we do have artificial intelligence. Software is doing all kinds of things that we used to think only intelligent humans, say, could do. But increasingly, software is demonstrating that computers can do things that we thought once upon a time only humans could do. And so as this software gets increasingly intelligent, as it becomes perhaps more human-like, but not necessarily more human-like, but just more intelligent generally, the time may come when software is intelligent enough to produce more software that's even more intelligent than itself. And at that point, that will be the last thing, according to a singularitarian, perhaps some singularitarians, that may be the last invention that humans ever need to make, because from that point forward, computers would be making themselves better and better at a rate that we can't even comprehend. So there is a very special case to consider that information technology plays a role in this because of the importance of artificial intelligence in the consideration of what the technological singularity may be.
Hey, Lincoln, just for fun, could you talk about some of the pop culture that's incorporated some of the singularity ideas? What came to mind when you were going through that rehearsal of artificial intelligence was iRobot.
Oh, yeah. There's, you know, Isaac Asimov, of course, did all kinds of things related to robotics. Isaac Asimov, a science fiction author that wrote iRobot, the book after which the movie was made, he actually never really foresaw, as best I can tell, a technological singularity. He foresaw more of kind of this linear progression of technology into the future. It's been more recently that we've started to recognize or acknowledge the potential impact of accelerating technological change. And so a new form of science fiction has kind of come about, a harder science fiction, if you will. One of the really, I think, fascinating books to have been written on this subject is called Accelerando by Charles Stross. I'd recommend it to people who want to read some science fiction that incorporates this this notion of a technological singularity. But it's actually a very difficult thing for people to internalize.
and understand well. And there's a story that I often share with people to underscore just how difficult it is to understand the effects of exponentially changing technology. It's a story about, we'll say, a king and a mathematician who served in the kingdom. And the mathematician had done some great things for the kingdom. The king wanted to reward the mathematician, called the mathematician into the court and said, good mathematician, you know, you've served the kingdom. You can have anything you want. The mathematician tells the king, oh, well, I just want rice. And the king says, well, you just want rice? That's all you want? He says, yeah, I want the number of grains of rice to be determined in this way. I want you to put one grain of rice on the first square of a chessboard, two grains on the next square of a chessboard, four on the next square, eight, 16, and so on, doubling the number of grains of rice on each square of the chessboard until you fill up the whole chessboard. And the king said, are you sure that's all you want? And the mathematician said, yep, that's all I want. And the king said, granted. And so, you know, the servants come in, they start putting the rice on the chessboard. And before they've even filled up, you know, the first two rows, maybe three rows of the chessboard, they've already filled the entire courtroom. And at that point, the king starts to realize he doesn't have enough rice in the entire kingdom to pay the mathematician what he asked. And in fact, I calculated this once, and just to show the impact of this, I'll just ask maybe Dan, just guess, how much rice, like volume-wise, do you think would have satisfied the mathematician's request, just intuitively?
No clue, but I actually know the number from your article.
Okay, so
maybe
Tyson, throw it out there intuitively. Yeah. What is it? How much volume would the rice fill?
I'm currently reading Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, and so I know that that my mind is not intuitively designed to calculate statistics. And so I'd have to yield to the mathematics of it. So
I'll cut the story short. Yeah. Basically, it would cover the entire planet with like a kilometer of rice.
Wow, deep.
Yeah, that's a lot of rice. And so this just goes to show, although you and I, who know this story and who know this idea of exponentially accelerating technological change, we think we get it, but we don't at a deep intuitive level. We just don't get it.
There's another great example that's also pretty quick, and that is if you take like a regular sheet of typing paper, right, and you fold it in half, and then you fold that in half again, and you fold that in half again, and if you did that 50 times – people, you know, have some intuition of what that might be. And they think, you know, it might be a few inches thick if you folded it in half 50 times. In reality, if you actually could do that, it would reach to the moon and back.
There you go, yeah. And so what are some of the kind of the practical things about this? Well, over the last 30 years, we've seen a billion-fold increase in computing capacity. And we are going to see another billion-fold increase in computing capacity, given current trends, over the next 30 years. So what does that mean? Well, you know, 30 years ago, computers filled entire warehouses. Today, I have an iPhone right here in my pocket that has more computing capacity than those computers that filled warehouses. And it's sitting here, you know, it's a few inches long, right? You know what iPhones look like. Yeah. Well, 30 years from now...
Sorry, can I give a couple more examples there too that I think are really fascinating? Because there are things that we encounter every day, but we never think about this. One of those little electronic birthday cards that you open up and it plays happy birthday and you read it and you throw it in the trash has more computing power than the Allies had in World War II. The smartphone that people carry around in their pocket has more computing power than NASA had in 1969 when they landed a man on the moon.
Wow.
So that gives you just a sense of how we just don't really intuit what exponential growth means, and yet we are experiencing it all the time.
Yeah.
So haven't we just by definition excluded ourselves from truly understanding what's going to be happening at the singularity? If it's such a dynamic, evolving point in history in the future,
if we stay as we are now, certainly, no question, we're excluding ourselves. You know, 30 years from now, my iPhone will, the computing capacity of my iPhone will fit in one of the cells of my body.
So and that's why transhumanism is really important for people, right? Because we have to grasp this and we have to deal with it. This is coming. This is what is happening. There's no question about it. Those trends are very, very clear. But unless we can change something about ourselves, we are going to be, quote unquote, left behind, right? We're not going to make it through that singularity.
Well, and left behind might be a positive scenario compared to some possibilities, right? That we could use this technology to destroy ourselves.
Yeah, fascinating. You know, it begs the question of, you know, a lot of religious fundamentalists, instead of saying, let's inject morals into this future, it would be, let's do everything we can to fight, to shut down, to kind of go in a Luddite direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, but is it even feasible that resistance like that would stop
right.
progressing?
No, probably
exactly.
not. And if you look historically, the reason I say probably not is that we see, you know, as people look historically at technological trends, we see that even in times of great social turmoil, like through World War I and II, technological progress continues. And
right.
so, you know, people are, you know, there's of course arguments being made about this, but the argument most persuasive to me, based on, you know, my studies of the subject, is I think it would probably take nothing short of a global catastrophe to stop the direction that our technology is heading. Because,
no,
you know, if you shut
right.
it down in the United States, it's going to start up in China. If you
right.
shut it down in China, it will start up, who knows, in Africa. You know, half of Africa has cell phones already. So they're learning more than they've ever learned before.
Now, we should right. recognize that, you know, there are religious fundamentalists who would like to take advantage of technological advances to destroy progressive civilization and to try to fight against other technologies. And I think that it's important for us to recognize those risks. And I think that this is also one of the reasons why we need really persuasive religious arguments as well, because I think a completely non-religious or anti-religious transhumanism will not speak to the hearts of people who don't see a connection back to them and the things that they value. And I think that creates a significant risk. And I think we see this in the culture of the world right now. So I think this is why we have this incentive to marry religious thought and transhumanist thought, because we have to deal with these things and we have to do so in a way that addresses the concerns of fundamentalism in important ways.
Yeah, and, you know, to build on Chris's thought there, some people have kind of straw man criticized transhumanism as being technology fanboys, and frankly, nothing could be further from the truth. Transhumanists are deeply, by and large, deeply concerned with the risks presented by technology. Some of the more well-known transhumanists have even authored and, you know, compiled edited books on just the risks associated with advancing technology: extinction risks, global catastrophic risks. In fact, that's the title of one of the books, is Global Catastrophic Risks by Nick Bostrom, who's a transhumanist philosopher at Oxford. Transhumanism is not just about, hey, rah, rah, the future
right.
is about making everything greater through technology. No, it's about, oh no, too. Look, not only can we do wonderful things with technology, but we can do horrible things with technology. So we had better not only be seeking to pursue the opportunities, we should be seeking to mitigate the risks.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.